inviting anyone that wants to go to Sunday school. Not everyone leave, please. Anyways, so you're welcome to do that.
We're all huddled in Darcy's
room. Yeah. Wouldn't that be something? Okay. Ready to roll, Jordan? Okay, good. Okay, so as it turns out, I thought that I had managed what is called a finesse, and that was there were three Sundays that were needed for when John was going to be away. And so that kind of got divvied up, and so I agreed to do one of them. And then, of course, Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyways, but then we remembered that Anita Pierce is someone that we like to, who is a missionary we support, and we always like to bring her in. She's such a dynamic speaker and a real blessing for us. And so we thought, well, why not bring her in for one of those three Sundays? And so I graciously gave her the space that I was going to take, and I thought that I had done such a wonderful thing. Until she wasn't able to come in June, and so then I was instantly put back in the batting lineup, and so here I am this Sunday, and I am more than pleased to be here, and hopefully what I have to share with you is something that you can find of value, and so I'll just start with prayer. Heavenly Father, we just come and we just thank you for each and every person that has come here today. Please be with us and be in this place. And please guide and direct the words that I say and the message that is brought. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so the topic that I chose was ordinary people, amazing feats. And I hope that what I share here is going to make some sort of sense. And so, as an introduction, I just want to take a moment to consider if any of the following would qualify as examples of the message title. And so I'm going to kind of be relying a lot on the PowerPoint. And so here's the first example of ordinary people and amazing feats. So this I just, and some of these I just pulled off the internet as examples. I believe they are true, as much as you can tell. But anyway, and so this is just one that's just text. I am a paramedic, dispatched to a fire to stand by. We happen to be one of the first units on the scene, along with the police officer. The house is fully engulfed, and outside, this woman is frantic that her husband in a wheelchair is stuck in the doorway. Without question, the officer sprints inside to grab him without any fire gear or protection. My partner and I looked at each other and followed him. Fortunately, the gentleman in the house was close to the door, and we were able to get him out easily with minimal danger. What makes it selfless, though, is that the officer didn't know he was going in and didn't even question his own safety for a second when he heard someone was stuck. And so that's the first example of just something that I thought I would put out there. So let's just go and turn to the next one. These have different kind of angles to them. Dale Beatty, making life easier for disabled veterans. And if you look at the picture, there was a much better picture, but to fit the thing, you'll just see, just right along the edge of the picture, you'll see that gentleman there's got an artificial leg, and in actual fact, his other leg looks exactly the same. So after Dale Beatty lost his legs in the Iraq War, his community thanked him for his service by helping him build a home. To pay for it, Beatty co-funded Purple Heart Homes, which has helped build or modify homes for dozens of disabled U.S. veterans. "We wouldn't leave someone behind on the battlefield," Beatty said. Why would we do it at home? So that's another one to consider. And now let's take a look at the next one. I just got a few of these just to kind of... Okay, a restaurant in my town has a board with "no questions asked, prepaid meals for people in need." And here's a picture of that board. And it reads, if you are hungry and have no money, these meals have been paid for in advance. Give a server the ticket, and they will have the kitchen prepare your meal. And there you can see a whole variety of meals that they can choose from there. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like that, but I think that is an awesome thing. Yeah, you've seen that?
There's a restaurant in Hamilton that that's what they do.
Is that right?
Yeah,
awesome.
There are a couple pizza places in downtown that do that.
Yeah, okay. So that's kind of cool. And so I guess in terms of the theme here on this one, it would be whoever is behind putting that in place in the restaurant and stuff. Okay, the next one. To the person who noticed my sunroof open during a thunderstorm, thank you from the bottom of my heart for your random act of kindness.
Yeah.
And anyways, so I thought that one's kind of cool. And there was one other I read, and I didn't end up putting it in, but I think it was really kind of cool. This was a story. This guy was walking down the sidewalk in the city when there was a fairly large downpour of rain and had an umbrella. Coming the other way, he saw this mother with this baby walking in the rain. And as they passed, he just handed the umbrella off to the lady and kept walking. And so that was another one that I didn't have. So anyway, the idea of these is ordinary people, amazing feats. Now, these don't sound like anything really fantastic or anything. The media might, in some good news story or whatever, mention them or something like that but they certainly, in a lot of ways, may not be considered as amazing feats. But I just thought I would start with that to get us thinking, and you can be thinking whether or not that sort of thing would actually qualify under the theme. And we'll move on, though. But our next, our Bible verse to put in context with this message today, I took from Psalm 68:35 from the New King James Version, and it reads, O God, you are more awesome than your holy places. The God of Israel is he who gives strength and power to his people. And so if you're thinking of it in terms of amazing feats, and you're thinking of it in terms of God being involved, this Bible verse kind of puts that into kind of a context, I think. And it just shows where a lot of amazing feats can come from. And I think that in terms of this message today, the message we're going to have here is that certainly in the case of amazing feats, God is involved and that he can do things to make amazing feats happen. Now, the entire Bible presents examples of ordinary people who did amazing things. Now, I've just thrown up a list of people like Noah and Joseph and Moses and Joseph and Samson and David and Daniel and John and Peter and Paul, Timothy, and there are among many, and there's definitely more. And all of these, of course, we think are amazing people that have done some amazing feats. And I think that we have a tendency to believe that these were superhuman people from birth. Sometimes, like, my gosh, because you don't just get your name in the Bible because you're an ordinary person or so. And that it's, if you're in the Bible, you had special qualities and things all along. And so then when you came to your time, you were able to just really just run with it and do your amazing things. Because after all, they made it into the Bible. Well, when you really think about that, though, I would like to kind of look into a case where that maybe that's just not really the case. And in fact, far from it. And some of the people who end up being highlighted in the Bible, and these people above here, when you really think about it, they weren't amazing people, but they were people that were faithful to God, and God empowered them to do amazing things. And in some cases, like you could just look down the line, you know, like, and I, one time when I spoke, I kind of spoke on Noah and just the idea of, are you kidding me? I think was the name of that. And and sort of looking at it in terms of that's maybe something that Noah was thinking when God asked him to build an ark and things like that. And so in every one of these cases, these weren't necessarily people that started out very strong. And they were more ordinary than we may ever think they were, but they still managed to do amazing feats. And I guess the theme in this lesson here is that once God got involved with them, and if they were open and willing, he could do amazing things with them. And I guess that's kind of where I'm going with a lot of this. And so for today's message, though, I want to bring it down to one Bible character, and that is Gideon. And so just because the teacher in me likes to try and cover things maybe and not just say Gideon, but I want to put some background to him, and that also helps to fill out this whole message so that I can actually, you know, make it into a message. Anyway, so Gideon, he lived in the time of the judges, and the judges, I might have more in here after, but the judges weren't judges necessarily like we think of judges today. But they were wise people who were in tune with God and were leaders in the society of the early Israel. And Helen, if I'm right, you can give me a nod and say that's about right or so. Anyway, or no.
Not sure about that wise part.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah, like, but there was a series of them that were leaders. And this was not a time that they had a king. Israel did not have a king. They had the judges. Okay, and let's put Gideon's time and age in perspective. And so I might be repeating myself here a little bit. So around the time of 1400 BC, the Israelites led by Joshua entered the promised land. And so that's about the time. So you got to remember they had been left in Joseph had brought his family down after he was taken down to Egypt. And, of course, God blessed him, and he did amazing feats and became second in command of Egypt at the time, just under Pharaoh. And with God's help and direction and the miracles that he performed, he was able to then bring his family down. And that basically is where the children of Israel really were incubated into a nation. And then from that, of course, then the time of Moses came and the oppression, because the new Pharaoh was had no respect for Joseph or anything like that, and so then they became slaves. They were no longer honored guests. They became slaves and were oppressed. And then, of course, Moses, through the help of God and all the miracles and things, led them out of Egypt and into the wilderness, where they did not necessarily, it took them a lot longer to get over to the promised land than what it should have. But around, they took them 40 years, I believe, and in that time, we started seeing some amazing things. And it was not necessarily things that I would say would be amazing in a good way. But one of the things is that this was what the Bible described as they were a stiff-necked people. And by that meant they were stubborn, and they were unruly, and they were exhausting to lead. And, in fact, Moses' father-in-law finally helped him coach him into, because I think he was just about done with it all, and then he kind of coached him into how to maybe to manage this throng. Because in the face of amazing things that the Lord was doing, like, for instance, manna was falling down every day except the Sabbath from the sky. And they were eating this. And then quail, because they just got tired of just eating manna. And all of these things. And yet, despite all of that, there were members of the Israelites that strayed away from God. Like, really? Anyway. And so, but they gradually and they eventually got to the promised land. And, of course, Moses was unable to enter, but Joshua took the leadership. And when Joshua went in, he had God leading him, and the Israelites were very successful in terms of moving in and capturing the land that they were supposed to. And the land was taken in stages. They didn't just go and take it all at once. They had to manage that. And actually, most of the promise, or most of the land was west of the Jordan. But Reuben, Gad, and part of, I always have trouble saying it, Manasseh asked actually to settle on the east side of Jordan. And that was allowed as long as the army from those tribes came over and assisted in defeating the enemies that were around in there. And so they had to contribute to that. And then after a certain time when they were successful in doing that work, then they were released back to those areas of the land too. And all the tribes, plus the remaining Manasseh tribe, settled in the promised land west of the Jordan River. And these lands were assigned to each of the tribes by the drawing of lots, which was interesting, but that's how that was done. But the Levites were allotted land in a special way. So they didn't get their own section of the promised land. They had parcels spread out around a lot of the cities or settlements there, I believe, if I got that right. But they, in turn, because they had special responsibilities about maintaining the law and being leaders in that. And so, with that. So, just quickly, like this is still being put as in terms of perspective. So, at the time, when Joshua was basically done his work, and this is how the land was sort of divided up, this would have been Israel in the time. And so, you can see where down below is the Dead Sea, and up higher there, way at the top, is the Sea of Galilee and that. And so that's kind of where everything came together. Now, we're gradually working towards the time that I want to talk about in terms of Gideon's time. And so at this point, I'm going to read Judges 2, 6 to 23. Disobedience and defeat. And so this slide here says the time of the Judges 2 to and there. And this is going to really talk about the cycle of falling away and the disobedience followed by the rescue of God. And this was a cycle that kept going on. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to his own inheritance. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen the great things that the Lord had done in Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110, and they buried him in the land of his inheritance in Timnath Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. After the whole generation had been, you know, the thing in the Bible too is when they put locations sometimes where they're buried, then they'll say, and they're still there today. Well, I don't know if anyone knows where exactly where his grave would be or something.
Today refers to the day that this was written.
Yeah, that's right. After the whole generation had been gathered up to the fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord God of their fathers and who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed the worship of various gods of the people around them. They provoked the Lord's anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Ashtoreths. In his anger against Israel, and the Lord handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever the Israelites went to fight and the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them. Just as he had sworn to them, they were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshiped them. Unlike their fathers, they quickly turned from the way in which their fathers had walked, the way of obedience to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of the enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, "Because of this nation has violated the covenant that I laid down for them and their forefathers and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep their way of the Lord and walk in their forefathers as their forefathers did. The Lord had allowed those nations to remain. He did not drive them out at once by giving them into the hands of Joshua." And so that kind of gives you the picture of in Gideon's time and the time of Judges, the cycle of disobedience and forsaking God, even though in this time it was the amazing things that the Lord had done and how this had all been created. But it was nothing that seemed to stick with these people. And even if judges came along and sort of rescued them from their troubles, as soon as they had the chance to go back, they quickly went back. And so we turn to Judges 6 to 10, because we're gradually moving right into the time of Gideon. 6, 1 to 10. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites and Amalekites and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel. Neither sheep nor cattle nor donkey. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. When the Israelites cried to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them a prophet who said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I snatched you from the power of Egypt and from the hand of your oppressors. I drove them from before you and gave you the land. I said to you, 'I am the Lord your God. No doubt, do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live.' But you have not listened to me." And so that gives you a real situation. This was a dire situation in Israel. And so Gideon was part of this, and we'll be looking a little more at this. But just because the teacher in me wants to go in depth on this, when we talk about pagan gods, we can look at it. Baal was one of them that keep coming up. And so there's a picture I have of worshiping the god Baal, and there's an altar with some weird figures on it. I don't know whether you can really see, but you get the idea. And this was, and when the worshiping of Baal was even, they were sacrificing their own children and stuff like this. It was just gross and totally evil. And how the Israelites could get themselves into that, I don't know. I just don't know. Anyways, the other one was Ashtoreth. I think that's how it's pronounced. And one of the things is they made these poles. And there's a picture of one, and that's an actual picture. So there's somewhere that someone had of that sort of thing, and it was a hideous sort of pole. And so the what were they? It's the god Ashtoreth, and what's the name of the poles?
Asherah.
Asher poles. Yeah. And so these would be put up, and the Israelites were worshiping these and totally forgetting about God. And so this was the kind of thing that was going on. Now, the enemies of the Israelites, just to give you a little background about them, there were the Midianites, and those were the ones that were very much put into the picture here. And they were the descendants of Midian, one of the sons of Abraham. So these were from the original time when Abraham's there in the family. People that never did go, were not part of the children of Israel, but were part of the Abraham's family. And they were a nomadic tribe in lands east and southeast of Israel. So that's where they were kind of hanging out. And that's where they would come in and torment the Israel. And then there's the Amalekites. And these were descendants of Amalek. And that's the grandson of Esau. And they were the first nation to attack Israel. So then, if you think back, Esau and Jacob were brothers. And this Esau was the one who gave his birthright, sold his birthright to Jacob for a pot of stew or something like that. And so but as the story goes with that, actually when Jacob came back from when he was over and found his wife's and he was working on, he brought his wife and family back. Well, there was a restoration with Esau and Jacob at that time, but time has moved on and this was not the case anymore. And so the Amalekites were another nation, and they were the first to attack Israel, and I believe they were, when they were just traveling up to at the original time, they were one of the first ones there. And the Amorites, was a pagan tribe believed to be descendants of Canaan, one of Ham's sons. And so they go way back because Ham was one of the three sons that came off the ark. And so then the descendants of Ham were mainly in that area where Israel was set. So those are some of the connections with some of these enemies. Okay, so now I'm going to read Judges 6:11. The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash, the Abizrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in the winepress to keep it from the Midianites. So here's Gideon, and here's a picture of... Now, that's a sample of a wine press. I don't know. There's different ones, but I thought I'd give you a picture of what a wine press might look like. And I'm sure there must have been some other... This, is, of course, is part of an archaeological dig, so I'm sure there was things about it that I don't know how it was supposed to work. But one of the things is it's a small area, and it was dug down. And I've seen them where they're on a stand or something like that, and it runs down. But this one, obviously, is a wine press that worked a little differently. But anyways, so Gideon was kind of hiding out, threshing his grain out of sight because, of course, he was concerned about the Midianites and the enemies there coming and stealing it from him. So that doesn't sound like someone that is, well, it's kind of smart, I guess, but he is not someone that he is, was definitely not a real courageous man at the time. He was just trying to get by and just trying to keep his head down, stay low. Now, the other picture is a threshing floor that would be the usual place where they would thresh. And I think in the Bible, a threshing floor was kind of a gathering place because there was lots of people around and it was very visible. And so when you look at that certainly wouldn't work for lying low with your grain and food because everyone would see you're out there threshing your grain and probably the Midianites would get that sooner or later. So anyway, so there was Gideon thrashing his grain, hiding out in a wine press to do this, trying to just get by. So now I'm going to read Judges 6:12-15 as the story goes on here. And so when the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." Now, he's saying this to a guy that's hiding in a wine press threshing his grain. Kind of doesn't sound like a mighty warrior to me. Sounds more like an ordinary kind of guy just trying to get by. But, sir, Gideon replied, if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all the wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian. And the Lord turned to him and said, go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? I'm just making sure I read to the, yeah. But Lord, Gideon asked, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family. So here is not someone that looks at himself as being great at all. If this isn't an ordinary guy, then I don't know who is, even if it's at Bible times. Now, it's interesting because in this passage, you sort of, it gets a little confusing to me because at some point you're hearing him meeting with an angel, and then other times he seems to be talking directly to God. So I guess the angel of the Lord, and so however that works, we'll just go with it. Anyways, so there he was, trying to, being rather amazed and questioning whether or not, like, what are you asking me to do here? And so then the Lord answered, I will be, in 16 to 21 here, the Lord answered, I will be with you and you will strike down all the Midianites together. Gideon replied, if now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it was really you talking to me. Please do not go away until I come back and bring offering and set it before you. And the Lord said, I will wait until you return. So then in 19, Gideon went in, prepared a young goat, and from an ephah of flour he made a bread without yeast, putting the meal in a basket and its broth in a pot, and brought them out and offered them to him under the oak. And the angel of God said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread, place it on the rock, and pour out the broth. And Gideon did so. Okay, and then 21 reads, just lost it. When with the tip of the staff that was in his hand, the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared. So, wow. So there he just had an encounter with the angel and some amazing things happened. So he's being told that he is a great warrior. And this angel is there doing wonders. But at the same time, this is a little hard to, he's still struggling with all of this. And so we go on. And in 21 to 26, he's having I read 21. So from 22 to 26, reading on. When Gideon realized that it was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, ah, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. But the Lord said to him, peace, do not be afraid, you are not going to die. So Gideon built an altar to the Lord there and called it, the Lord is peace to this day. It stands in Ophrah of the Abizrites. The same night, the Lord said to him, take the second bull from your father's herd and the one 7 years old. Tear down your father's altar to Baal and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on top of the height, using the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down. Offer the second bull as a burnt offering. So right in front of Gideon's house, the father's name was Joah. Anyways, he had an altar to Baal and he had an Asherah pole. This is Gideon's father. So this guy that was hiding in the wine press then comes out, cuts down the Asherah pole, and does what God asks him to do. So Gideon takes courage and action. So Gideon took the 10 of his servants and did as the Lord told him. But because he was afraid of his family and the men of the town, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. Well, but he did it, and so good for him. And so he did this. So he destroyed the altar for Baal, and he also destroyed the Asherah pole. Now, the story goes on, and of course, in 28 here, in the morning when the men of the town got up, there was Baal's altar, demolished with the Asherah pole beside it, cut down, and the second bull sacrificed on the newly built altar. They asked each other, "Who did this?" When they carefully investigated, they were told, "Gideon, son of Joash, did it." The men of the town demanded Joash, "You bring out your son, he must die because he has broken down Baal's altar and cut down the Asherah pole beside it." Now, this next bit, to me, I find very interesting, because here's that Joash's response to this. But Joash replied to the hostile crowd around him, "Are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by morning. If Baal really is God, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar." So that day they called Gideon Jerubbaal, saying, "Let Baal contend with him because he broke down Baal's altar." So that's kind of a neat little maneuver there, because I would imagine that Joash wasn't really that excited to lose his son. And it also tells me that even though Joash had an Asherah pole and an altar to Baal, I'm not so sure that he was really committed to these evil religions. I think so. And he was just kind of making sure that he fit in with the crowd and just did the things that to make him think that he wasn't going to be threatened or persecuted, and that but when it came right down to it, he didn't seem to be that upset. Because if he would have been a devout follower of Baal, I would think that he would be in there just destroying Gideon just like everybody else. So that I find rather amusing and interesting about that. And that sort of thing has happened before, like when in the days around Elijah, and saying, "Well, let's have a showdown here." And when you actually challenge their faith in their gods and stuff, and of course they're empty and meaningless, and so then of course the truth comes out. So anyway, so that's where we're at. So now Gideon has done some things, and he is becoming a little bit stronger and a little emboldened by what God is asking him to do, and he did it. So now if we move on here, in Judges 6, over in Judges 6:33, it reads, "Now all the Midianites, Amalekites, and the other eastern people joined forces and crossed over the Jordan and camped in the valley of Jezreel." Okay. And so this would have probably been another raiding party that they were doing, and they were probably moving in there to raise havoc with the Israelites. And so then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, summoning the Abiezrites to follow him. He sent messages through Manasseh, calling them to arms, and also into Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, so that they too went up to meet them. So good for Gideon. He is already starting to do some amazing things. He's putting out the call, and he's sort of rallying the troops. And so there we go. We've got this new Gideon, and with confidence and boldness and ready to do amazing things, right? Well, kind of. Because if you look in Judges 6:36-40, though, the story goes on. And then when he has this all rallied, then Gideon says to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. So he's already met an angel that burnt up the supper, and he's already been directed by God to do things that he did, but he is still kind of an ordinary guy. He's still needing more reassurance. And so he asked God, well, I'm going to lay this wool fleece down, and here's what I'd like you to do. If there is dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said. So he was willing to step out and try and do amazing things, but he wanted a little more assurance from God. And that is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed out the fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowl of water he had. So there. Now, because that was a miracle that God, who has been speaking to him and told him. Like, let's just check it. Okay, he had an angel come and talk to him, and he had conversations with God one way or the other. And he had been directed to do these things. He's been told that he is going to be a mighty leader. So there you go. Like, wouldn't that be enough? I guess not. And so then he put that fleece down, and God made that fleece wet, just like he asked. So that's got to do it, right? Wrong. Okay. And this is, okay. Then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me. Let me just make one more request. So this ordinary guy is still, this time make the fleece dry and the ground covered with dew. And that night God did so. Only the fleece was dry and all the ground covered was dew. Now, this to me is a sign that God is very loving and patient. And how many times have we maybe tested him too? Maybe not quite to this extent. And we haven't been asked to conquer a nation or defend our country or something like that. But I'm sure that too, that there's times that God has to be patient with all of us. Because we are maybe ordinary people. But he's willing to work with us. And if we have a willing heart and are willing to trust in him, he is willing to help us do great things. Well, I think that this kind of leads us to the fact that after this, Gideon was all in. He was totally trusting in God. And if we look ahead in chapter 7, then you get into the other part of the story where God even tests his faith more. And Gideon is all in because he is no longer questioning it. Like when he had just a small army, he wasn't that large, and he was going to go against the Midianites, and God asked him to, he says, you got too many. You got too many soldiers. And then goes into the story about having them observe them as they're drinking water from the brook, and then he pares down the army and stuff. And God's explanation for this was that you've got to have fewer soldiers because the glory's got to be coming to me. That there's no doubt about it, that it's through my hand, through you, that we get the glory. And from what I can, we're not going to read Judges 7 and that, but I believe that he's at a point where he's not questioning that anymore. He is full of faith, and he has now become someone that is doing amazing feats. And the story goes on, of course, where they basically trick him. They trick the Midianites that were down in the valley, and they went down and spied, and the soldiers were talking about the dreams they had, and so then when they actually did the attack where they're rolling fire down in there, and then they basically panicked, and the Midianites destroyed themselves. And so because of Gideon's unwavering faith, once he really got into this, he did perform an amazing feat. And so this is kind of the story, or the message is, that I'm not just trying to make a message here where I'm updating you as to what happened 3,500 years ago. That's not my point here. My point is, though, that this is an example of what God can do if you're allowing him to work through you. And that you can be an ordinary person, but you can do amazing feats if you allow his power to work through you. And so, in conclusion, I guess we ask, how does this apply to our service to the Lord today? Do we see examples of ordinary people doing amazing feats? Now, when we go back at the introduction, I showed you some things that weren't anything that was earth-shaking, but they were at the same time some pretty cool things. And I think that when you really think about it, some of the people in those first introductory slides were basically ordinary people doing amazing feats. And because the things they were doing were amazing. But we don't know whether or not the Lord was involved in what their efforts were and what they were doing. But if we ask, do we see examples of how does this apply to the service of the Lord today? Do we see examples of ordinary people doing amazing feats? And I would say that, yes, we do. And we do not have to look any farther than what goes on in this church. Yes. And there's no doubt in my mind that the efforts that we have here are done with the power of God. And I could identify different things that happen. And that each and every one of you is involved with this in one way or the other. You know, like whether we're talking about the Friday Games night and the work that's being done there, Rich and Sue and the other people that are strongly supporting that. And then again, we look at Howard and Jill and all your work and your connection with Mexico and what you've done with that. And in connection with that, the one that just really, it's, you know, that's all amazing that goes down there and the dedicated people there. But the one that really strikes me is Tony. I just think his dedication, and he's the one that uses his money and the money he gets, and he goes out to the canals and is feeding people, but at the same time, he's preaching the word to them. And even when Sam went down there and we talked about, he has a vision for doing more there. And I would absolutely not be surprised if he doesn't have that come to be, simply because he is a man that I believe is no longer ordinary. He has the power of God working through him, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of feats he comes up with. And then there's all the other ones, the efforts around VBS and the dedication around that and the music ministry. And I'm mentioning some things, but I certainly am not leaving anything out. It's anyone that does any kind of work, whether in here or beyond, and is working to promote the Lord's work in the kingdom that is really, in my mind, is ordinary people doing amazing feats. And I think that is my conclusion for today's message. I think that with that, I think we'll call up Rich to do a closing song.